You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Masterclass.
This afternoon, we're bringing you a masterclass on the polygraph test, also known as the lie detector test. And so from that brief understanding, just preparing for today, it's clear that it's designed to analyze physiological reactions to questions that are being asked to the subject to determine whether or not that person is being truthful. And the reason why this has come up is because one of our listeners sent us an email immediately, almost still in the morning after Solim Simango on Monday spoke to Bongani Bingwa, and he outright said on the station that I want a lie detector test and for the results to be made public. This is in relation to the allegations against him of sexual harassment from a former DA staffer. And so this case is ongoing. You may have heard Nkele Malopa this morning speaking to Bongani once more as the matters around this case deepen, saying there are many more others who feel that they cannot come forward but who feel represented by her case. And so that's one aspect. And our listeners said, could you please do a masterclass on the polygraph test that Solim Simango is saying he would like to take and for the results to be made public? And it's not the first time that we've had public figures in South Africa contend that a lie detector test or polygraph test needs to be used to determine who is telling the truth. You will remember that advocate Nwako Ramatlhodi challenged former President Jacob Zuma for both of them to take lie detector tests, saying that the president lied when he appeared before the Zondo Commission, where he accused the advocate of being a spy. And so he said, to prove that the president was not telling the truth, I'm challenging him, and I am willing to take a lie detector test, saying we should undergo the test together with him, a polygraph tool conducted publicly by a professional psychophysiologist, that's a polygraph examiner, who then will detect the deception. And then over and above that, there's an interesting matter before the courts. And the matter was brought by the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa. And it relates to the dismissal of three warehouse workers at a Silveray stationery company in Harriedale in Johannesburg. And so the affidavit states that the union, according to the union, the workers were instructed by senior manager to undergo the lie detector test. And when they refused, they were dismissed for being insubordinate and for breaching their employment contract, which state that workers agree to submit themselves to polygraph testing. And so we are going to take a closer look at the polygraph test. What questions do you have? 011-883-0702, 31702 for your SMSs and your voice notes and WhatsApps on 072-702-1702.
702. Masterclass.
Right. So we'll take your questions throughout the course of this conversation as we speak to Charles Kemp. He's at the Polygraph Institute of South Africa. Charles, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lasagna. I hope you are well.
Yes. I'm hoping by the end of this, we'll start to understand more about the polygraph test and where we should place it, you know, as far as accuracy and credibility is concerned. So let's get going. I read a quote once that I think, and I'm going to kind of butcher it and just say it in my own way, that and I wanted to know from you whether or not it's true that the lie detection starts the minute that the subject comes into contact with the tester, that from the minute you encounter the person, you're looking for other cues. Is that true?
Not really, no. See, a polygraph examination is effectively a standardized scientific examination in which we look for certain physiological responses that have been correlated to the act of being deceptive. Due to the fact that it's a standardized process, for us to try and make assumptions before we even do the test would actually not be good.
So reading body language and looking at other cues, that doesn't, if someone could come in sweating and soaking wet, that does not mean that they'll fail.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, we have an old saying, which is trust the chance. Now, you might speak to someone and they could look a bit funny or whatever the case might be, but that does not mean that they're guilty or not being truthful regarding the matter on the investigation. So Well, we do start from the second we shake their hands, in that we don't want to influence the subject that is about to undergo the examination. But the result in itself is based purely on the physiological response that we record during the test itself.
Yeah. Okay. So what does the test record? What are the functions that it collects in order for us to produce this chart?
So there has been certain physiological responses that, as I've just mentioned, have been correlated to the actor being deceptive on a statistically significant level. Effectively, we look at respiration excursion length or sustained decreases in respiration amplitude. We look at electrodermal skin activity, specifically a phasic response in electrodermal skin activity, and cardiovascular activity, specifically with regards to an increase in relative blood pressure. What is most important during polygraph examination, though, is not the specific responses, but how they compare between the relevant questions and the control questions as asked during the examination.
Right. And so you have a base, you ask a number of questions to establish a baseline values.
That's actually a bit of a myth. People often think that we ask one or two questions, we get to see what the baseline is, and then asking questions to get responses from that. But that's not quite true. Mm-hmm. So effectively, during a polygraph examination, we look for the significant differences between the control questions and the relevant questions. We know from the analytical theory of polygraph testing that we should see greater changes in physiological activity loaded at different types of test stimuli as a function of deception and truth-telling in response to relevant target stimuli. This sounds like a bit of a mouthful, but essentially during a polygraph test, we ask relevant questions and we ask control questions. The relevant questions would be regarding the matter on the investigation, and the control questions, as the name suggests, these are questions that we either get the person to lie to on purpose or prompt them to lie to during the examination by asking vague questions or questions that a person can't
give me examples. Give me examples, Charles.
So a relevant question would be, did you steal my wallet, if the case was that my wallet was stolen? A control question would be, before you started working here, have you ever stolen anything at all? And that would then give us the comparison that we require to determine if a person's answering truthful or not.
Mm-hmm. And then no or yes answers. Is that what you encourage, or is an explanation to the detriment of the subject?
No, a polygraph examination is approximately an hour to an hour and a half long, actual testing phase is only about 20 minutes. So just to give a quick rundown of what you can expect if you need to go sit down for a polygraph test. First, there's going to be an introduction. The examinee is going to explain to you exactly how the equipment works, what you can expect from the examination. They're going to talk about your rights with regards to the examination. They're going to explain the components. They're going to make sure that you're medically fit for the examination. And then they're actually going to have a discussion regarding the matter and the investigation. And only after that do they go over the exact questions. They discuss the questions and make sure that the examinee understands the questions fully. There's no point in asking a question that the person doesn't know if they're answering truthfully to. Mm. And only after that do we do the actual test. So during the actual test, it's strictly yes or no questions. But in the pre-examination interview, a person is given a lot of chance to explain exactly what they want to explain and to talk to us as much as they want to regarding the matter on the investigation.
Does that count in the results, or is it strictly just what was spotted on the chart?
No, the results, as mentioned, will be strictly what is spotted on the chart.
So that additional deception indicated. That additional explaining doesn't necessarily contribute to or add any weight to how the outcomes.
Well, unless the person says, yes, I stole the wallet, that would make our job a lot easier.
Okay.
But so any information given before the actual examination, we do take it into account with regards, we hand it to the investigating team and they can use that information to corroborate the investigation and to plan ahead. But with regards to whether we deem the person as deceptive or no deceptive or non-deceptive, that's strictly based on the data from the charts.
Right. Let's go to Gerard, who's calling us from Randburg. Hello, Gerard.
Hello. I'm not quite sure what's been said, so my question may be a bit out of date, but is it possible that that system can be beaten if the person had pre-taken a very strong tranquilizer?
Great question, Gerard. Thank you. So, the impact of taking a tranquilizer. Charles?
Good question. One we get a lot. So, as mentioned, we look at the responses and the control questions and the relevant questions. If you do take a strong tranquilizer, what's going to end up happening? If it does influence the physiological responses that we look for, we're not going to get any reactions anywhere. That's going to result in what is called an inconclusive examination. So in other words, we're not going to have any statistically significant data to make a conclusive or valid or reliable decision on the examination. So that would be a very bad idea because you won't end up passing the examination, you won't end up failing the examination, you'll end up having to go for another one most likely.
So what the effects that the tranquilizer has on those physiological measures that you're looking for will just, what does it do? Does it make them inconsistent? Does it just dull all of them? What's the impact?
Well, it depends on the tranquilizer. So if it's beta blockers, it will most likely inhibit the physiological responses. So we're not going to see any physiological responses happening. So to give a bit of background information with regards to the physiological responses itself, we look for responses that's controlled by the autonomic nervous system, more specifically the sympathetic autonomic nervous system.
Yes.
And what the system does is it causes, it innervates certain internal organs to act against what is happening in the environment or to compensate for workload or whatever the case might be.
Yes.
Now, if you were to take enough tranquilizer to subdue those reactions, we're not going to get any data or enough data from the body to really make a decision. If we do get enough data, we will still see the difference between the sexual indicator and the sexual indicator. But if there's enough tranquilizer taken that it would be able to inhibit any responses, it's going to do so across the entire examination, and that would be an inconclusive result.
So what, that affects our flight response?
The fight, flight, freeze response is actually it's fairly problematic. And the reason for that is fight, flight, freeze reflex and psychological set were two psychological theories presented for the working of polygraph examinations, historically speaking. But those are deemed to be very problematic. And the one reason for that is if fear was the driving factor with regards to a polygraph examination, then first and foremost, directed lie control questions would not work. And researchers found that they work pretty much the same as the probable lie control questions. So, and they're not fear driven. And the other thing is psychopaths would not react to the examination. And interestingly enough, we find that psychopaths react to polygraph examinations despite the fact that they should have a very low fear response. So in short, fight, flight, freeze reflex and the fear reflex, psychological set, we don't really take them into account anymore. But what the tranquilizer would do, so those effects you were talking about would be considered psychological effects, and tranquilizers would have a biological or physiological effect. So with terms to psychology, it won't have any influence there. But what it could potentially try to do, or that would probably be the point of taking these sort of tranquilizers, would be to dull the body enough that there's no responses occurring in the body. So, for example, your heart rate should stabilize. There should be no increase in blood pressure, no increase in electrodermal activity. But as mentioned, if we see no responses or physiological responses occurring, we're going to see them on the control questions as much as on the relevant questions. Yeah. And we'll know that there's a problem.
Okay. Let's take this question from Ngwako. Hi, Ngwako.
Hi, Azania. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the gentleman, Azania, that if you have uncontrolled blood pressure, surely your pulse would be like irregular, high at times. Knowing that they put those devices perhaps on your fingers and whatever, would that then maybe result in you getting a negative result on the assessment?
Great question, Ngwako. So about hypertension, uncontrolled hypertension, and let's take a listen to this voice note as well so that you can answer both of them, Charles.
Greetings, Jabu Chilwani in Mkondo. About the polygraphy test, I would like to know how accurate is it in terms of percentages. And another question is that can nervousness of a person results with the polygraphy test being inaccurate. Like, it seems as if I told a lie, but the reason is that I've been nervous. Thank you.
All right, we thank you so much. So we'll bundle those two. And Ngwako, let's start with Ngwako's question about hypertension, uncontrolled hypertension. What impact does that have?
Sure. So both of them very good questions, and one we answer pretty much almost every examination. So with regards to hypertension, hypertension doesn't fluctuate uncontrollably. So during the examination, we present the questions with about 20 to 30 seconds space in between, and we look for the physiological responses that occur directly after the, well, inside the response onset window. Now, for blood pressure problems to have an impact on the result of the examination, the blood pressure would literally need to increase at very specific times throughout the examination and decrease throughout very specific times. So the long and the short of it is blood pressure does not influence the examination in any way, shape or form. In fact, most medical conditions, as long as your body is for the most part acting normally, you should have a fine test. There's very few medical conditions that would make an examiner stop an examination completely. And when we do, it refers to things like active psychosis or severe heart conditions that could cause a medical emergency.
Hmm.
But normal everyday blood pressure, normal everyday anxiety and nervousness for that matter as well, will have no impact on the examination. In fact, we expect every single person to be nervous.
Yes, I was going to say, how do you factor that in then, that we're already stepping into the examination room probably fearful, even though you're not guilty? The process in itself strikes fear.
Mm. Well, so effectively, again, what we look for is a very specific set of physiological responses, and these responses occur in a very specific response window. So nervousness, anxiousness, they tend to remain fairly consistent throughout the examination. Same with high blood pressure. When you sit down, you have a standard baseline of what your body is, and they're not going to change in the very specific pattern that we're looking for on the test. So I mentioned earlier, we look for changes in breathing patterns. We look for electrodermal skin activity, and we look for an increase in blood pressure. So those are the three main scoring criteria that have been identified.
Okay, let's drill down.
Let's drill
down so that we can understand. Respiration-wise, what is my inhale and exhale? What's my respiratory system doing to demonstrate that difference, that variability you mentioned?
So on the examination itself, with regards to respiration, we've got two rubber tubes across the chest. They're called pneumograph tubes. And they effectively see how you inhale and exhale throughout the examination. We see a decrease in amplitude with regards to exhalation or inhalation during the examination itself. We see a shorter recurse flow length, and we could potentially see apnea. Now, apnea would be when a person exhales and then stops breathing. Mm. So we've basically got a static line on the chart. So that's basically what we look for in breathing. But the interesting thing about breathing patterns is they are not only controlled by the autonomic nervous system. You can literally control your breathing as you're sitting there right now.
Yes, I was going to say, but there's breath work that allows you to kind of circumvent that system and say, well, this is how I gain calm over my body by, you know, using certain breath techniques.
Yeah. So The interesting thing about the breathing patterns, they're controlled by the nervous system in general, the motoric nervous system. You can tell your lungs to breathe in and breathe out as much as you want,
mm-hmm.
which is why they have the least impact on the scoring criteria, what we're looking for.
Oh.
And mostly when we look at breathing, we can use that to determine if the person's cooperating with the examination or not. Sometimes examiners will monitor the person's breathing directly before and after the examination, as opposed to in the middle of the examination. If you see a significant change there, you can know the person's controlling their breathing on purpose for the test, and so forth. So for breathing, we do look for very specific patterns with regards to, as mentioned, the amplitude changes. But it's not the most important scoring criteria for us. That would be electrodermal skin activity,
mm-hmm.
Which is essentially, we put two electrodes on the fingertips. We send a very small electrical current through the palmar region of the hand, and we can monitor the resistance of the, well, the conductance or resistance that the electrical current phases. And this shows us the phasic electrodermal skin activity. Now, the electrodermal skin activity is not controlled by your motoric nervous system. You've got no influence on that whatsoever. And it's also essentially the strongest responder that we look for on the examination. It's got the highest scoring criteria. Now, that, for example, would not be influenced in any way by blood pressure. It won't be influenced in any way by nervousness or anxiousness. And we only look to see phasic responses, so short responses of between 5 and 20 seconds when asking a question on the test. And specifically, we monitor not if there's responses, but how the responses compare to the control questions, how strongly they compare to the control questions, and do they compare based on the stimulus? So not just a random response that occurs during the examination.
Wow. So can we feel this current?
No. That's also a very, very common question. No, you've got no idea.
It's insignificant.
You can't feel it at all.
Okay. Well, Charles, Stay with us and we'll finish the conversation around cardiovascular activity as we paint a picture about exactly what happens during a polygraph test.
Just for 28 years.
702. Masterclass.
Right, it's 20 minutes to 3 o'clock, and just like that, gosh, there's only 20 minutes left to our conversation. If you have any questions about the polygraph, do get in touch, as we've been speaking to Charles Kemp, and he joins us to outline how the system works. He's from the Polygraph Institute of South Africa. So Charles, we looked at respiration is one of the things that you test and record, skin activity, the skin activity, and then now let's look at the cardiovascular activity that is measured as part of the polygraph.
Well, that's actually a very simple one. So during the examination, blood pressure cuff is placed on the arm, it's inflated during the examination, and we monitor for changes in blood pressure during the test. Now, technically, we can see other changes as well, such as heart rate, but we do not take that into consideration. The only one that's really taken into consideration is a change in the blood pressure base. Now, I think what is most important to understand in all of this is not so much the reactions itself, but when they occur. You know, people think they're nervous, their heart's beating fast, therefore, if we put them on the test, their heart's going to beat fast and we're going to fail them. That's not how it works at all. So during the examination, essentially what we do is we ask a question, we look to see if there's any changes that happen when we ask the question, and those changes in itself is what we take into consideration. Now, if you're nervous, your nervousness is going to stay with you throughout the entire examination. If you've got high blood pressure, it's a medical condition, it's going to stay with you throughout the examination. So it's not too much of a concern. You don't need to be too worried about being nervous for the test. Like I said, it's quite normal. We expect people to be nervous. If you're accused of murder or criminal activity, you will definitely be nervous. It won't influence the examination.
Yeah. So let's look at how it, or rather it's used by companies. So companies do use the polygraph. It's accepted at the CCMA. What is the accuracy rate? So we had Jabu asking that earlier on.
Also a very good question, but also a bit more of a difficult one. And the reason for that is the answer would be depends on what test you use. So if we look at a couple of accuracy rates with regards to a diagnostic or specific test, so this is a test that we use when investigating a specific incident. The Utah zone comparison technique using probable lies, for example, it's got a confidence level of 93%, ranging from 87 to 98%, which is quite accurate. If you're looking at something like the AFMGQT with the empirical scoring system, it's got a confidence of 87%, ranging from 79 to 95% confidence. So the long and the short of it is it does depend on the type of examination. Specific examinations are a lot more accurate. As mentioned, the Utah hanging around 93% accuracy based on all the research that's been conducted on it. I hope that answers the question.
But then the thing is, if we're looking to prove guilt, and the higher we would look for something and the consequences, when we think about the consequences, you would hope that whatever you're relying on to prove that someone is lying should have a higher probability.
Well, that's why the specific examinations does have the highest probability. In fact, if you look at the Utah, it's compared.
Ooh. Will you try and get Charles back there, Abel? And in the meantime, let's go to Malusi calling from Pretoria. Hi, Malusi. I see it says that you're a polygraph operator.
Hi, Az. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
I'm well, thank you. And also, greeting to your host. Yes, I did qualify with polygraphy in 2015. I qualified under the American Polygraph Association.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, what I want to say is it works. It is a complex psychophysiological process, but it works. Now, what I wanted to clarify to many people is that people have doubts about it based on perception. But factually, it works.
Okay. So when you say perception, I thought it was dismissed because of not just the accuracy, but to say that it's not an exact science.
It is a science.
So why is it dismissed? Why is it dismissed then?
No, many people believe that, no, you can beat the machine, you can, I don't know, maneuver around the test or something.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to say is that the accuracy actually depends on the knowledge and proficiency of the operator himself.
I see. Okay. So,
And if a plus is when an operator has done, like I've done, advanced statement analysis, I've done investigative interviews, investigative body language, it becomes a bonus.
I see. Okay. And we were going to look at the additional tools and even the newest technologies to support the field. So
yes.
When you say, tell me what you're basing that on. Are you saying that the findings did prove to be true in the end? As in what you saw on the charts reflected what was revealed in real life?
Yes, because why I'm saying that is, before the machine can be mounted on any individual, you'll have this interview with the particular examinee.
Yes, Charles did mention.
And that interview will be very intense. It will be very, sometimes it's invasive, but you have to get the person to calm down and talk to the person. In most occasions, you will realize before you even go to the machine whether it might be deception indicated or not deception indicated, or whether the particular person didn't have anything to do with the issue at hand.
Yeah.
So when you go to the machine, basically you are just certifying that what you've noticed during the interview might be true or not.
Okay. So the type of test, yes. And of course, as you said, the skill of the operator.
Yes. The experience of the operator is very, very paramount.
Mm-hmm. And, all right.
Yeah.
Malusi, thank you so much for your contributions. Malusi in Pretoria. Bruce, you're in Northcliffe. Hello.
Hello. Hello, Eva and your guest. I personally once was subjected to a lie detector test when we had a vehicle stolen. The insurance company insisted that I go for this test. But they didn't call it a lie detector test. They called it a truth verification test.
Oh, wow.
Be that as it may. I did pass it with flying colors, but because I wasn't lying. But I can tell you from my experience, I don't think you can beat that machine. You can't. The way a professional bloke who asked me those questions, you can't fox him. You can't fool him.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But my question I wanted to ask your guest, I'm curious. There's this bloke called O.J. Simpson who famously underwent a lie detector test and passed it. And it was said that he had been coached or he had been trained to beat it. So is that true? What does your guest have to say about that?
Okay. Bruce, thank you for raising that and sharing your experience. Ashraf, I see that you also have a question on that front. Hello, Ashraf?
Hi, Azania. Okay, so basically what happened to me many years ago is I worked for a company that I won't mention the name, big international company, and we had a laptop that was stolen from our IT department. A polygraph tester was brought in and subjected about 20 to 30 of us to a polygraph test. You had a right to refuse the test, of which I think three out of the lot of us in IT refused. I was one who said, yes, I'm happy to do a polygraph. We're all very excited about this thing we'd only seen on TV. I went happily through the polygraph test, and guess what? They said to me, there is a more than 70% chance that I was the person that stole the laptop. So I actually laughed at the guy, and I said, come on, are you being serious? Are you going to tell me now who stole this laptop? He said to me, no, I'm being serious. You are the guy that stole this laptop, and can you tell us what happened? How did you do it? And I said, no, it wasn't me. And obviously I started panicking because I realized now that I'm actually being accused based on something that has come out of a machine.
Yeah.
So this thing carried on for about 4 to 5 hours of severe interrogation that I suffered, trying to get me to admit to it. And I at some point insisted on having a second test done. And I said, you know what, maybe there's a mistake here. Maybe I should go through it again.
Mm.
And put me through the machine again. The guy pulls a printout and he says, look here, you, and it starts off with things like, okay, is your name Ashraf? Yes. Is today Wednesday? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you work at the IT department at this company? Yes. Did you steal the polygraph? Did you steal the laptop machine? No, I didn't. Ah, and then it spikes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I can tell you till today, I did not take that thing. I obviously went to the CCMA.
Yeah.
I was reinstated at work. I could not work in the same IT department. They shifted me to another place. And about 3 months later, I resigned. I mean, I couldn't carry on because everybody at the company now suspects that I stole that, and I found a loophole to get back to work. So I just want to say from my experience, absolutely no faith. I'm happy that the South African courts do not accept it as evidence, in a case. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So Ashraf, did the second one also say you were guilty?
The second one was, according to the polygrapher, the second one showed an even higher percentage that it was me.
Okay,
so it was
I see.
Now we definitely know it's you. And the guy said to me that he goes to gold mines and he does all the tests on other people, and he's never seen a result as clear as mine.
Oh,
so
wow.
There I sat trying to argue with the machine, which obviously I couldn't. So, yeah.
Mm. Ashraf, thank you for sharing that. Yes. And I want Charles, let's weigh in on how it's used by different companies. I was relating a story or a case that's in front of the courts at the moment because this union on behalf of the dismissed workers has taken this case to the court because it went before the CCMA, and they even presented expert evidence from a professor who disputed the reliability of polygraph tests based on a number of reports, journals and articles. And he says, as per the professional body for psychology, polygraph tests are not classified as psychological tests in South Africa since they do not meet the standards of reliability, he said. And on top of that, the reports indicate that socially stigmatized groups such as black workers are prejudiced by polygraph tests because the evidence suggests that truthful members of socially stigmatized groups who are believed to be believed to have a higher likelihood of being guilty may show emotional and psychological responses in polygraph test situations that mimic the responses that are expected of deceptive individuals.
So a couple of questions that came through there. Let's go back a little bit. I'm going to get to all of that. But there was one about O.J. Simpson. So unfortunately, I'm not sure what happened with him. If the question is, can you be coached?
Mm.
It has happened before. We know, for example, there was a very famous case, Aldridge Ames. He was a CIA agent that turned double agent. He went through two polygraph examinations and passed them. But those are extremely special circumstances. And for the record, after Aldridge Ames was caught, another examiner had a look, well, a couple of other examiners. Obviously, there was a lot of questions regarding it. And they actually discovered that the results of the examination would probably be a deception indicator. And the fact that he passed it more to do with his personal relationship with the examiner than the actual results. So can it be done? Yeah, I know that there are programs where they have attempted to train persons to beat the polygraph test. I know that there's, in fact, persons asking schools, so to speak, asking money to train people to beat polygraph tests. The problem with that is that since 2007, it's been highly recommended that we use anti-countermeasure devices such as electronic seat sensors. They have been available before. But since the National Research Council report of 2003, one of the big critiques against polygraph testing was the the ability persons might have to mimic certain physiological responses and to beat the test. So as a result of that, we have anti-countermeasure devices in place, such as an electronic seat sensor, which literally monitors for the movements that a person would be required to do in order to try and beat the test. Also with that, the current algorithms of the software that is used during an examination actively monitors for certain discrepancies and monitors when these discrepancies occur to determine the probability of a person deliberately trying to manipulate the examination.
Okay.
So for the most part, if a person does try and beat the test, we'll pick it up, more likely than not.
Yes. And what do you think of the issue around a socially stigmatized group, as the phrase is used?
That was presented by, I think, Dr. LaRue was the name in the case, and he was referring to the research conducted by the National Research Council. So this was in 2003. That is one of the theories that they presented as a possible issue with the examination, but it should be noted that a lot of the theories that they did present there, they couldn't actually find any literature to back it up. So there was a concern that certain stigmatized groups could act or react stronger to the examination. But the first thing that's important to note, this is in the United States itself, mm-hmm. which does not necessarily translate over to South Africa. The other thing that's very interesting is the directed light control question technique. There's no evidence to suggest that there's any cultural or any differences in how persons react to that. But most importantly, most of the critique that was given in the National Research Council of 2003 was addressed by the polygraph profession, mostly by the American Polygraph Association, in subsequent research and protocols implemented. So that's, for example, one of the reasons why we now use electronic seat sensors. That's one of the reasons why the profession is only allowed to use validated testing techniques.
And there's new eye technology, isn't it? So, the testing of how the eyes have dilated.
Yeah, the Converse Eye Detect system. It's a very interesting system. I think it was Dr. Raskins that was one of the persons developing it. We actually have one of those in South Africa at this point. But quite frankly, it's not nearly as widely implemented. And unfortunately, the problem with Eye Detect, such as most other physiological detection of deception technologies, it simply does not live up to the robustness and accuracy of a polygraph test.
I see. Let's go to the lines as we conclude, Charles. Dumelo in Benoni, we come to you first and we go to Ben. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Dumelo. Go ahead.
Good, good. Yeah, so my issue with polygraph is that, you know, some employees, some employers rather, they use it as their main evidence. You can't do that. It should be your supporting evidence. For example, remember in labor law, the standard of proof is on balance of probability. So now, let's say I left my 10 rand in my office. One employee is seen entering my office, but then later my 10 rand is not there. So meaning that he was the only one who had access to my office. And his colleagues know that this person on that day didn't have money to buy lunch, but all of a sudden now he has money. You understand? Mm-hmm. You can take that person to a polygraph to support your evidence, to say this circumstantial evidence, you know, it proves, you know, that this person might be the one who took the money, you understand?
Yes.
So, but you can't use it as your main evidence.
All right.
Okay, because you failed the polygraph test, that means you are guilty of stealing. No, it can't be.
All right. Thank you, Dumelo, for that. We'll get Charles's final comment. Ben, you say the same. You had the same experience as Ashraf.
Yes. Hi, Azania.
Hi.
I wasn't going to call, but after the gentleman called, I decided, look, let me call, because what happened to him happened to me exactly.
How many tests did you endure?
Well, one.
Okay.
I wasn't going to take the second one after I was told that, it came back, or the test indicated that I failed. And, what happened is that where I work, they stole two laptops and a couple of people, including myself, were subjected to this test. And then they teach me that I failed, and I knew I had nothing to do with what happened. So
yes.
I kind of lost faith on this machine test, really.
Mm. Charles, I am out of time, but a quick assessment on Ben and Ashraf's situation?
Certainly. So the first and foremost, the most important thing to remember there is that if a polygraph examiner belongs to a professional organization, such as the self-regulatory professional body, the Southern African Polygraph Federation is the one I belong to, for example, they are required to adhere to certain ethics, standards of practice. They have to have certain qualifications and so forth. So if you feel an examiner acted in an unethical way or did not act professionally or did not conduct it properly, you can reach out to the professional organization to which they belong to have a look at it. If they don't belong to a professional organization, well, that's probably not a good start from the get-go.
Yes.
But that being said, if you feel that the examination, the results were simply incorrect, as mentioned, contact the self-regulatory body. They can have a look at it, and they can determine if there was a procedural error or if it is, in fact, the correct result. Because, unfortunately, the problem is with persons saying, I didn't do it. Well, that's what everybody says.
Yeah. Okay, it's not going to be enough. All right. Thank you so much, Charles. We wait to see if we'll ever get a polygraph taken in public in South Africa, as our politicians tend to suggest. Thank you so much for listening to that masterclass.